don't think that I could find an easy way. So if I see you walking hand in hand in with the young man, you know I'll understand. But you should have been my shoes yesterday.
Fall by Bland Melon on Planet Waves FM Pacifica Radio. Thanks again, Jen Atkins, for that suggestion. A couple of things I forgot to mention. One is that I am planning a week off from the program on Friday the 14th. I usually have something else cooked up. I've got a couple of things in the can that might be or might not be appropriate, or I might just kind of not participate at all, just have the full opportunity to back away a bit, and planning to rest up that week for my embarking on the annual readings for Planet Waves, a major, let's say, astrological tool that I offer each year now. I think we're on to year 23 or 24. But I've been doing this maybe 23. I think the first year I did was 1999, so this will be 2023. Maybe 24th year. I don't know. I have trouble calculating the years. Anyway, it's called Inner Space. Maybe you've seen the announcements. The presale begins on Sunday, if I can pull all that together, after Mercury stations direct. And what's different this year is for the first time in 2 years, I'm planning a written annual with audio, but written. I used to do it written every year, and then when this lockdown thing happened, and I was summoned to other business, I've only done one written annual in that time, and that's called an Aquarian era. Anyway, Inner Space will be a written hybrid with audio reading. And I'm planning to have that on the 31st of December. So in advance of that, I'm going to take a breath of air, go find an ocean, and hang out there for a few days. So you won't be hearing from me that week. But I am going to have a horoscope, so that I will I will do. Another speaking of astrology, then we're going to move into the realm of understanding fraud. Is that Mercury stations direct on Sunday morning in Eastern time zone. Let's get that chart going. More window events. Stations, Mercury stations direct. Now, the Mercury retrograde, everyone hears about this. Now that the internet exists, it's like Mercury retrograde, Mercury retrograde. It used to be nobody had even heard of this, and now everybody knows what it is, and even more people are experts. Mercury stations retrograde in Virgo, 24 degrees and 12 minutes on October 2nd, this coming Sunday at 5:07 a.m. EDT. For some, that's going to be very early on Sunday morning. Some, it'll be more like overnight. Like if you're in Europe or UK, Eastern Europe, it's going to be overnight. And I guess if you're in, like on the other side of the dateline, it'll be very early Monday. And my basic assessment of Mercury stationing direct is that it is something that describes the truth revealed. and maybe a whole lot of truth revealed. Now, it's not just any old truth, right? It's truth that you are seeking the answer to or that you're wondering about. And sometimes there can be very specific revelations of things that you had no idea were even possible. This chart looks like it could be something that kind of blows up big and kind of goes out of control. There's a lot of aspects in this chart. Mercury stations direct in late Virgo. It does so in a trine to Pluto, in an opposition to Neptune, in a quincunx to Eris. It is making a lot of aspects to slow, powerful outer planets. And that's one of the ways you assess the scale of an event like this. Another way you assess the scale is you look at what the moon is doing. And the moon, just about 2 hours before, has entered Capricorn. And so the moon is making contact with a lot of points in early Capricorn, including outer planet Ixion, that's out by Pluto, outer planet Quasar, that's out by Pluto, outer planet Pholus, that's a little bit further in, currently probably Neptune grazing, it's not quite out in the Kuiper Belt. And then the moon, so the moon is powered up by all of these deep ancestral type of influences. And then, this is all on Sunday morning, and then the moon is going to be square Venus, the moon is going to be square Jupiter, it's going to be square the sun, then the next day, about a day later, it's going to be square Chiron. The moon is making a lot of aspects. So you know that you've got a loaded chart when your target planet, the thing you're considering, is in aspect to many outer planets, and when the moon is doing some big stuff. Both of these things happen to be true. So this should be an interesting week next week as whatever this is ripples around. Now, I know it all looks like it's huge and meaningless at the same time. But this, because of all these factors together, this is a bit of a step beyond. All right, so Reiner Fulmich. I'm not sure when he makes his debut on the COVID thing. One of the people that he works with, Wolfgang Vodrog, I think if I got that right, was one of the first presenters I heard talking about problems with the real work never having been done on the isolation and purification of the virus. That means he was one of the first people who said, there's not a virus. You have not shown this, even using the scant, sketchy, useless rules of virology. They didn't get anywhere near this. So at a certain point, this guy Reiner Fulmich emerges, and he is running this thing called the Corona Investigative Committee. What they did is once a week, I don't know, every Monday or every Friday or something, they've had a kind of a panel discussion that was structured as a kind of a deposition, an interview, but the interview was an investigative interview. It's so far as they were investigative. And there were a couple of weird things about this group, one of which was that they have an extreme bias against anyone taking the position that SARS-CoV-2 has never been shown to exist only in computer models, metagenomic transcripts, as a concept, not as a thing roaming around the biological world. And 209 governments, agencies, entities, state, federal, provincial governments, and entities like the NIH and the CDC all admit this. They all say, we don't have any sample taken from a human host. And this is like the biggest non-story in the history of history. You would think, this is really important, that 209 governments and institutions and states and provinces and pretty much everyone, unanimously, they all admit all they've got are metagenomic transcripts. They didn't even say that much. They say, no, we don't got any bananas. There's no sample available taken from a human host. And all of the studies point to this. All the studies are all studies in metagenomic transcripts. Phony sequences made from a big brew of cellular stuff and poison in a tiny little sample from a human mixed with like 99% other things, which makes no sense if you're trying to find a thing in that sample. You're not going to mix it with monkey cells and calf cells and everything else. And it's funny that the committee took this position so vehemently when I learned early in 2020, watching a video in German by Wolfgang Vordog, I call him Vordog, that the work had not been done. That always stayed in the back of my mind. The work has not been done. They've never actually done the things they need to do to find this thing. So the Corona Committee has been blatantly hostile to the no virus position. So then it happens that the Purnima Wah thing goes down, which was largely my doing, exposing someone who is claiming to have done a study which proved beyond any doubt that there was absolutely no particle of SARS-CoV-2 in what she claimed were something like 715 or something samples from COVID-positive pneumonia patients in California, and they couldn't find any. Turns out the whole thing is bullshit. But in Reiner Fulmich's last appearance as a member of the Corona Investigative Committee, he appears on a webinar with Purnima Wah and invites her to testify before the committee. So when he's finally going to have somebody like spill the beans on the no virus position, it turns out to be her. 100% completely full of shit. And it was only 36 hours later that I broke the story about her not having PhDs and not having done these experiments, not knowing the first thing about the study she claimed to have done. And then the Corona Investigative Committee spontaneously breaks up. Now, I thought maybe they didn't, there was obviously more to it, but it struck me as a little straw that broke the camel's back that Fulmich invites her on to in front of the committee. Now, who is Fulmich? Invites her in front of the committee that is blatantly hostile to her position, and then it turns out that she's a complete fraud. Okay, now, Fulmich is an attorney. I have verified this. He is admitted to the bar in California. He claims to be admitted to the bar in Germany. That's kind of rare. And the California bar exam is a real ball buster. It takes 3 days. And so we have no reason to believe he's not an attorney. He claims to have been and is of various, let's say, record and secondary sources, part of the litigation against Volkswagen for their fraudulent emissions detectors and Deutsche Bank for its various crimes against humanity. So we all assume this is true, right? I mean, this is, and it's really no different than Purnima Wah, except we know he's admitted to the bar, but we only have sketchy stuff about what he actually did on those cases. And I'm not saying he didn't work on them. It's very likely that he did work on them, but we don't know what he did. And on cases like a case against Volkswagen, there are going to be anywhere between like 10 and 50 associate counsel. And then there's going to be people below the partner level who are managing the discovery process and doing trial preparation. Then you're going to have the executives up on top, and you're going to have the people who are bankrolling the whole thing, because that's what happens when you've got a potentially good lawsuit. There, you seek investors in the lawsuit. This is actually how it's done. And we don't know where he was in that whole maze. I am eager to see a piece of legal paperwork with his name on it. So again, I'm not saying that he's not on the paperwork somewhere. I'm just saying that in all of this, I haven't seen it. But the thing that got my attention about Fulmich is he never really sounds like a fraud attorney. Now, earlier in my career, it seems like a couple of months ago, but it was really 1990, 92, 93, and 94, and 95-ish, that I was working with, as my sources, a group of attorneys who were doing fraud litigation on this scale against GE, Westinghouse, and Monsanto. And these attorneys liked my journalism enough to say, looks like you can really do this. We've got some documents for you. And they said, ask us any questions you want and do whatever you want with them. There was no deal involved. I just was asked to do my best, and I said I would do my best. But in the process, I got to know fraud lawyers on a number of different levels, including the level of the very basic people processing the documents, coming out of the box from Westinghouse and going to the discovery productions and standing at the copier and making the copies and sorting through them, doing the first read, and then the kind of discovery chief, a guy named Paul Merrill. In this case, he was set up with an office in Las Vegas because it was the power company suing the manufacturers of these deadly chemicals. And then I got to know some of the lawyers who had laid the groundwork of litigated and argued much, much bigger cases. So I read a lot of depositions, and I learned how lawyers are supposed to think, especially if they're litigating large corporations for fraud. One of the guys I work with was a guy named Bill Snyder, this guy with this like perfect Hoosier accent, this guy from Indiana who went to law school, but he wasn't admitted. And I talked to this guy probably every day for 6 months. He was sort of involved in vetting me and making sure that I was the right person to release these documents to and to do these stories. And he taught me a lot about how you think and how I believe it was from Bill that I first heard the term admission against interest. An admission against interest is when the defendant it can be anyone, but in this legalistic structure, it's when the defendant, a company like Volkswagen, GE, Monsanto, Moderna, whoever it might be coming up, admits to the thing that they're being accused of. Sometimes it's blatant. Sometimes it's subtle. Sometimes you've got to put a couple of pieces together, but sometimes I just come right out and say, this is what we did. Oops. Sometimes they've got a strategic reason. Sometimes they fuck up. So, listening to Reiner Fulmick all these years, really 2 years, a little more, and I'm not an aficionado of this thing. I haven't like watched every one. I've seen 5-10 interviews. I have wondered where the gears on his wheels are. There seems to be something going round and round, but the gears never seem to mesh in terms of doing the single most important thing that lawyers in this situation, public advocacy against major organizations, are supposed to do. They are supposed to be able to spot issues. Bill Snyder said to me, lawyer's job is to spot issues. I'm like, lawyer's job is to spot issues. Wow. So that became my standard for evaluating lawyers. Can they spot issues? Can they come up with a good theory based on those issues of how to proceed? And are they aware when their adversary, remembering the law is an adversarial process, makes an admission against interest? So I'm going to play for you about 7 minutes of Reiner Fulmick making a presentation back in May on CHD TV, Children's Health Defense Television, which has also been extremely resistant to admitting that there's a problem with this whole notion of a virus and this whole existence of SARS-CoV-2. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the founder of CHD, pushing the lab release theory, which might be plausible had there been a virus found. But if you don't have a virus, what do you have coming out of a lab? This is my issue with Peter Bregan too. I'm gonna revisit the mass formation psychosis theory next week. So RFK Jr. totally averse to this no virus position, and then they made up for that somewhat last week with bringing my friend Mike Wallach, a documentary filmmaker, onto CHD TV, but it took 2.5 years. Anyway, back in May, RFK Jr. puts on CHD TV none other than Reiner Filmich to explain very basic issue of why the COVID test is a fraud. Fraud has many different, let's say, branches of the fraud. Who is injured by the action, how they're injured by the action, they have to have been deceived. And so with the issue of the PCR COVID test, and all of them, but really the PCR is the one that was used to manufacture the illusion of an outbreak in a pandemic. The one thing that you need, without which you don't have fraud, is intent. There must be intent on the part of the person committing the fraud. Intent does not mean desire. Can be, but it does not have to be. Intent means that the person committing the act knew or should have known of the consequences of their action. Intent. Now, with that in mind, let's listen to Reiner Filmich attempt to explain why the PCR is fraudulent. Here you go.
PCR test is a great tool. It was invented by a brilliant mind by the name of Kary Mullis. He won a Nobel Prize for this in 1992, I believe. It cannot be used for diagnostic purposes in the sense of finding out whether or not somebody is infected or even ill. Why is that? Well, there's basically two reasons. Reason number one, the test cannot distinguish between dead and live matter. So if you test positive, it means that it has found a fragment of the coronavirus, because that's what it's looking for. It only looks for the coronavirus. It doesn't look for any other viruses. So it has found a fragment of the coronavirus. But this may very well be the remnants of your body's immune system's fight against the common cold or the flu, because coronaviruses, there are four of them, are endemic. That means they exist, they've been in existence and cohabitating with humans for decades. So if it finds that coronavirus, it could very well be that it's just the remnant of your body's immune system's fight against the flu or the common cold, which may have happened 4 or 5 months ago. For an infection, you need to have a whole virus, and that's reason number two why it can't work. You need to have a whole virus enter the cells and starting to replicate there. That's when you're infected, because that's when you have symptoms too. So you need a whole virus. This test never finds a whole virus, because whatever is on the swabs that's taken from the nose or the throat is crushed so that there's no whole virus left anymore. And then you put it into a machine, and then this machine is set so that you will know and see what is really in there. This is done, this is a kind of magnifying, I guess you could call it. It's called cycles of amplification, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, etc., etc. But everyone agrees now that anything beyond 24 cycles of amplification is totally unscientific, because you all of a sudden everything becomes visible, everything and anything. And Mike Eden told us that at 35 cycles of amplification, you end up with at least 90% false positives. Now, the first tests that were designed in the context of corona by this now infamous professor, Dr. Drosten from Germany, were set at 45 cycles of amplification. This was recommended to the entire world by the World Health Organization as the gold standard for the detection of viruses, in this case, the coronavirus. Even the Frankfurt Public Health Agency says we do not consider anything beyond 24 cycles of amplification. If you also take into consideration that at 35 cycles of amplification, you end up with at least 90% false positives, what do you expect at 40 to 45 cycles of amplification? So those are the two reasons why no matter how you apply the test, it cannot tell us anything about infections. It cannot distinguish between dead and live matter, and it cannot find a whole virus. However, as I just said, this test was applied in a very unscientific manner. It had so many, what they call the Corman-Drosten protocol, which is a kind of an article they wrote on how to test people with the PCR test. It has so many defects, so to speak. It's a highly defective paper. But the worst of it is that they recommended cycles of amplification of 45. That is guaranteed to produce false positives. They needed cases in January of 2020, but there weren't any. There were no cases. They applied a lot of pressure on the World Health Organization, asking their emergency committee to meet. They met in mid-January, but couldn't agree on the declaration of a public health emergency of international concern. The term pandemic is for the general public, but internally, what they really wanted is this public health emergency of international concern. But in order to declare this, you have to have cases. Why did they want it, by the way? They didn't need it for lockdowns or mass mandates or social distancing, but they needed it for new, totally untested drugs to be used on humans. Unless you have a health emergency, that's what this is, a public health emergency of international concern, you cannot use untested new drugs. Because you're not going to get a what they now call in the U.S. an emergency use authorization, or in Europe it's a conditional use authorization. So they needed this public health emergency of international concern, but they didn't have any cases. But then, because they didn't have any cases, then they agreed, oh well, but it's still dangerous out there in Wuhan. We don't know what's going on. We're going to have to meet again 2 weeks from now. 2 weeks later, they met again. Then they declared the public health emergency of international concern. What had changed? Nothing. Except that this Drosten guy, Professor Dr. Drosten of Charité University in Berlin, he had provided them with his test. And with the help of this test, set at 45 cycles of amplification, they created cases. They had thousands and thousands of cases. That's how they created the public health emergency of international concern, and that is the only foundation for any and all of the measures, including and above all the so-called vaccinations.
Okay, my turn. So he sounds good, right? He sounds like he might know what he's talking about. Except that he really doesn't say one accurate thing. In principle, he says things that are broadly accurate, but remember that it is the work of a fraud attorney to spot the specific elements of fraud. Now, he is asserting that this Corman-Drosten protocol is a work of fraud. It should be the subject of many lawsuits. So far as I know, Fjellmark has not brought a lawsuit involving SARS-CoV-2 of the COVID pandemic. If I am wrong about that, someone please correct me. He was promising a class action lawsuit. So we know he was talking a game on bringing a fraud suit. We know that was his intent. And in this 7-minute conversation, he's trying to explain why the test is a fraud. So let's deconstruct what he said. And then I'm going to tell you what he got wrong and what he should have said. Now, remembering that by May of 2022, all you had to do was like read a couple of my articles, and you would have known much more than he revealed in 7 minutes on Children's Health Defense Television. So, first of all, he says that the test cannot be used for diagnostic purposes. Now, that is true, but there's reasons why it can't be used for diagnostic purposes. And he gives two reasons. The first reason is, this is the whole basis of his argument, is that it cannot distinguish between live and dead virus, which presumes that there's a virus. And he later elaborates on that and says, not only can it distinguish between live and dead virus, it finds exactly and only the thing it's looking for, except when it finds remnants of cold and flu and other things. That is not a clear line of reasoning. Either it can find exactly the thing it's looking for in this context, or it can't find exactly the thing it's looking for in this context. There's context when the PCR is wonderful, like finding impurities in wine. Maybe I'll get into that at the end. Then he says, it can't find whole virus. That's because he says virus is crushed, and that it does something and declares positives, but it can't find whole virus. Now, here he's absolutely wrong. It is not designed to find whole virus. That is not the point of finding whole virus. So, for example, if somebody's fingerprints are found at the crime scene, fingerprints are known to be pretty unique. I'd like to dig more deeply into that, but let's assume that fingerprints are unique. You don't need to find the alleged perp's whole body at the crime scene. All you need are the unique mark that person left at the crime scene. And that's what the PCR is supposed to find. It is supposed to find the unique genetic fingerprint in a small sample of the whole that matches the whole, and then be used as a kind of marker for having found the whole thing. So he never explains that. He doesn't even seem to understand it. What he's saying is it can't diagnose because it can't find whole virus. And, oh, by the way, it can't diagnose because it can't separate live virus from dead virus. This is very convoluted. It's not even an understanding. It's a complete lack of an understanding of what this thing is. Now, in theory, prior to using the thing diagnostically, there's supposed to be other work that leads to the identification of the whole virus. This is all in pure theory. I'll give a metaphor in a second. Not a metaphor, an example from PCR. And you are supposed to be absolutely sure that that is the disease-causing agent. But that work was never done, and you still have the problem of the false positive issue of the wrong things getting tagged, and the further problem of, let's assume there's such a thing as a whole virus that can invade a cell and become a disease bomb and all that, that it can't tell what was like last month's struggle against the coronavirus and the current struggle against the coronavirus. And we know from the work of Dr. Kevin Corbett that there is absolutely no relevance to viral load measurement. By the way, this was the famous viral load test of the 1990s. And I'm soon going to have Kevin Corbett back on the program to explain again, for sure he's sick of this. And we had the last time we had this conversation was in my car. And I was parked outside the laundromat, and he was like breaking it down. And he said, yeah, I was sitting with a patient who was dying. They had infections coming out all their orifices and absolutely no viral load. No, the PCR could find no HIV virus in them. That's really weird. Now, it shows you this thing is just not at all about diagnosis. What is it good for? And then I'm going to come back to Ryder. What it's good for example, if let's say you've got a known contaminant in wine. Let's say there's a mold that you don't want in the wine. You know the mold grows on grapes. Maybe it was a dry or extra wet year, for example. You want to make sure that your final product or something along the way doesn't have any of that mold in it. Well, you already have the mold. You have a sample of the mold, and you can sequence the sample of the mold, and you can find a strand of that sequence that is long enough that you can then instruct the PCR to find it in the wine without finding the whole mold. You're just looking for a representative sample, genetic fingerprint, and then you know there's probably mold contamination in that wine. This is a real story I heard from a lab technician who does use the PCR for this purpose. She's a wine analyst. Okay. The next issue here is that he completely mischaracterizes the nature of the Corman-Drosten paper in Eurosurveillance that gives the World Health Organization its testing protocol. And what he does not say is that the entire paper was exposed as a complete and total work of fraud. He says all kinds of problems. He alludes to it, but he doesn't come out and say this is absolutely no validity. And he also doesn't say that the Corman-Drosten protocol was the WHO's protocol. They didn't pressure the WHO. The WHO would give out the Corman-Drosten protocol if some little country like Niger or Cuba wanted to know how to test for this phantom SARS-CoV-2. They would send them the Corman-Drosten protocol. Then he makes a huge error in the cycle. Everything he says about the cycle threshold issue is wrong. The cycle threshold issue is how many amplification cycles. So let's say you're looking for wine mold, but you're below the detection limit for conventional analysis. So what happens is that wine mold is tagged with what are called primers and probes, and then the whole sample is mixed with an enzyme called polymerase, and it's cooled and heated and cooled and heated, and every time it's cooled and heated, the amount of DNA is said to double. Okay, whatever is tagged, whatever genetic material is tagged will double. That's a big problem right there. That is the, above all else, problem with the PCR being used for any purpose, but especially for diagnostic purpose. Then he says, we all agree that above 24 cycles is unscientific. Well, no, we don't all agree to that. It's going to depend on the purpose. And really, the complaints really start coming in at around cycle 19 or 17. We're like, what the fuck are you doing? Doubling the amount of genetic material. Doubling is a lot. By the time you're up to the amount they were doing for COVID, they were going a trillion times the amount in the sample. A trillion times the amount found in the sample. What Carrie Mullis, the inventor, said is if you have to magnify something a trillion times to find it, how could it possibly be harmful? The next thing he says is that at cycle 35, Mike Yadin, former Pfizer executive, you've heard him on the program, says you get 90% false positives. Well, let's analyze that. First of all, when are there any true positives? He says we go from suddenly there being all false positives to 10% true positives. At cycle 35. But what's actually going on at cycle 35, and we know this from Stephen Buston, who was interviewed by a guy named David Crowe. I have the transcript of this if you're interested. And what Buston, considered one of the world's leading PCR experts, says is that if you hit positive at cycle 35, that meant that the PCR found one molecule of the target in the sample. One molecule. A molecule, right? So that's a lot worse than 90% false positives, assuming that there's any. But then he goes, then we've left the realm of all of them being false positives to suddenly there's 10% allegedly true positives. Well, I want to know where these true positives come from. Now, what he is giving here is the official cover story for the failure of the PCR. This is the official cover story that was written about in August of 2020 in the New York Times by Apoorva Mindervini, star science writer for the New York Times. And in her story, she says that if you dial the cycle threshold back to 30, you lose 90% of your positives, according to health officials in New York and Massachusetts and elsewhere. What I engaged Mindervini on this issue, and I said, well, what about the coverage from 2007 by Gina Collada that said that the test blows 100% false positives, meaning there's not a single case among 140 positives of a claimed pertussis outbreak, a bacterial outbreak at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. She said, well, Mindervini says to me, and I've got this email thread somewhere, she says, well, that said that there wasn't an outbreak back at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, but we have a very bad outbreak, but we don't know if the PCR is amplifying the remnants of old fight with SARS-CoV-2 or the current fight with SARS-CoV-2, so we're not catching it soon enough. This was not in her article, and it led me to believe that she may not have even written her article and didn't even understand what was in it. But what Reiner, completely oblivious to all of this, Reiner says at 35 you have 90% false positives. It would seem to me like at 35 you have no false positives, no real positives anywhere, because not looking for anything, but you have a lot worse than 10% true positives. So he injects the story the same way the Times does, with the supposition that there is such a thing as a true positive, which is a complete failure to understand the nature of the fraud. And the nature of the fraud is not that the PCR cannot find whole virus, but that no one has found whole virus. And he neglects to admit that 209 governments and institutions and provincial governments, state and federal, and the CDC and the NIH and Health Canada and the National Health Service of England and 200 other institutions and governments all admit they don't have a sample from a human host. Now, if you recall, he's saying this on CHDTV. He's saying it on CHDTV about 2 weeks after I confronted Robert F. Kennedy Jr. publicly at a fundraising event with 200 people in the room and said, what about these governments? This, by the way, is the work of Christine Massey in the Toronto area. And he, too, danced around the point and wouldn't say, it sure is interesting that 209 governments have said they don't have any. Instead, he accused me of saying that viruses don't exist. And I never said that. I asked my question in a very precise and structured way. Comment on the fact that these governments have said this. He wouldn't do it. So we know CHD's position. They're not admitting the problem that the virus doesn't exist. And this is the entire dance that Filmic is doing. He can't admit that, they're using phony metagenomic in silico sequences. All the studies say this. And then all the test designs say we're using in silico sequences. And then you've got 209 governments and institutions all admitting they haven't actually found live virus from a human host. Well, what the fuck is left? So he misses the entire point of the fraud, which means that either he is giving the official cover story, which he is schmutzing up the issue on behalf of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who seems to be completely devoted, with the exception of having my friend Mike Wallach on the show a week and a half ago, completely devoted to not admitting this issue, but they did for 1 hour. This is not the way a fraud lawyer thinks. A fraud lawyer goes for the jugular. they explain why the official public relations position and the claims of mainstream science are not only wrong, but intentionally placed to mislead and harm people. And so if he's not seeing the intent involved, and he's making it seem like this is all just some kind of an unfortunate accident, well, there's another word for that. And that word is negligence. It is not fraud. Filmic makes one other huge mistake that he repeats at least three times. I heard him say it three times. He says that the Corman-Drosten protocol calls for a cycle threshold of 45, which is admittedly completely outrageous. If you've got to double the amount of genetic material in your sample 10 more times to find any, but at 35 you only had one molecule, assuming there was any. But the problem is the Corman-Drosten protocol does not set or recommend a cycle threshold at all. That is one of the biggest criticisms of the Corman-Drosten protocol. And it was kind of smart of them to leave out the cycle threshold, because had they left that in, had they said, oh, we have to run this thing at cycle threshold 45, a lot of people would have jumped on them and said, what are you kidding me? Cycle threshold 45, you run out of molecules at cycle threshold 35. And at cycle threshold 35, with one molecule, you haven't found anything anyway, because you can find one of anything in any one, as the inventor, Carrie Mullis, said. You can find a molecule of anything in any one if you look hard enough. So he repeats this three times, asserting that Corman and Drosten committed fraud by setting a cycle threshold that was too high, but they didn't set a cycle threshold. Now you could think, well, these are all forgivable errors. Yeah, they're forgivable errors if you're like writing a high school paper, but they're not forgivable errors if you are a famous fraud attorney who has supposedly sued Deutsche Bank and Volkswagen and won the cases. And you're trying to build your case before the public to explain why this particular thing is legally fraudulent, but you get every issue wrong. You're not correct on the structure of the argument to show intent. His facts are wrong in terms of the entire cycle threshold issue, and the flaw of the PCR being that it cannot find whole virus. He doesn't seem to understand it's not designed to find whole virus. So he doesn't understand the false claims. He doesn't understand the proper true use of the device, and he doesn't understand the assertions that are being made by the people who are committing the fraud. He's got it wrong everywhere he goes. And while the whole, you know, the Substack universe is all over Filmic based on the possibility that he may have made off with 1.35 million euros, blah, 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 and he's not a very nice guy and all this stuff, I don't really give a toss. What I'm interested in is, how does his mind work as a lawyer on issues where I think you will agree there's a necessary way to structure your arguments and you must have your facts right. I have worked with many of these lawyers, and sometimes even better with their wives, who know more than they do or who see things a whole different way and they really have it down. Two in particular, Carol Van Strum, the then at the time the wife of Paul Merrill, one of the guy leading the discovery operation in the PCB cases, and Ellen Ray, the wife of attorney William Schaap, S-C-H-A-A-P. Type his name into YouTube and you will find some interesting stuff. So I've talked to them. I've talked to associate counsel about this. I've talked to the lawyers who did the depositions and who brought the cases to trial. I've talked to the unadmitted lawyer who knew the entire case and wasn't practicing law but was just kind of helping manage the case. When I'm talking to these people, they don't let me get one syllable wrong. Not one syllable, not one meek interpretation of one fact. And it is not just a couple of them who are like this. In my experience, every last one uses any form of an interview or public discourse as a teaching session, of what this is about. And I am here to tell you that Reiner Fulnick, whatever he may or may not be, however money, much money he may have made suing Volkswagen and Deutsche Bank, whatever his signature may or may not appear in the legal pleadings, this guy is incapable of thinking like a fraud lawyer. He gets it wrong to the point where if this came through in a high school paper, I would fail it. That's a sad statement from a guy who's leading the Corona Investigative Committee to investigate the fraud. All he's doing is repeating the fraudulent public relations position of the manufacturers. Said another way, his arguments reveal and his complete lack of mastery of the facts reveal that he's working for the other side. I don't know where he's signing his paychecks. I'm just telling you that what he is saying is not serving the cause of truth or understanding the nature of the very fraud that he is trying to claim he's pointing out. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I rest my case. The rest of the program is pre-recorded. A month ago, the guest is Heidi Liscombe, who is taking the State University of New York at Albany to task on their ridiculous vaccine mandate that you have to be shot full of this deadly COVID jab to take a class or come onto the campus. She's not interested in doing like telecommuting to school. You want to take English seminar, you medieval literature, you want to be in the classroom with the professor and the other students. There's one other thing that I wanted to say before moving on. Oh, tonight, what I've got, I'm wrapping early, thankfully. In a couple of hours, I have a documentary crew coming to videotape me interviewing some members of the DeWitt family, this old family in this area, who dug up. I do make mention of a Revolutionary War era graveyard a block and a half from my house. Well, they got permission from the Dutch Protestant denomination to dig up six of their ancestors and find the teeth and do DNA analysis. And they're coming in tonight to record part of the Halloween segment, but a reality TV video crew is going to be videotaping me interviewing the DeWitt family. So that ought to be fun, and I'm glad I've got at least an hour before that all starts. So anyway, it has been wonderful being with you tonight. We're not done. We've got 40 minutes of the beautiful Heidi Liscombe, committed religious person, who's explaining why forcing her or anyone in her family to get these injections is a complete and total violation of her rights to exist as a human. All right. On that note, lots of love. Thanks for joining me. Once again, welcome to everyone from this long list of video and podcast shows I have been on. Thank you for your kind support of the program. And I'll be with you in 1 week, God willing, for the season finale of Planet Waves FM. Signing off for everyone here, all the awesome people who helped make this program possible, including yourself. Here's Blind Melon. Oh, I should really tell you what the other songs are going to be, since I'm not going to be able to say that. Right now, we're going to play Drive. I forget which album. There's only two possibilities. And then Soul One into Time on the outro end of things. Lots of love. God bless. And bye for now.
'cause this is all.